8 Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the pandemic may have shaken up your eating habits, but our guest says it's probably fine, from no meals and all snacks to one big, very large meal a day. Right now, though, we're going to talk about mental health and suicide. And I'll start off by letting you know that if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. You can also reach the crisis text line by texting HOME to 741-741. That's 741-741. We'll give you those numbers again at the end of the conversation. Mental health experts are hoping that Meghan Markle's recent interview with Oprah Winfrey will help reduce the stigma behind suicide. Markle said when she joined the British royal family, she became depressed. She blamed racist and sexist headlines and tabloids and said they deeply hurt her friends and family, and that the negative coverage would finally stop if she took her own life.
But I knew that if I didn't say it, that I would do it. And I just didn't want to be alive anymore. And that was a very clear and real and frightening constant thought.
Markle also said she let a senior official know that she needed help, but was told she couldn't get it because it would embarrass the family. Eventually, she and her husband, Prince Harry, along with her young son, Archie, moved to the U.S. and stepped away from their official roles in the royal family. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to what Meghan Markle had to say about those suicidal thoughts? Has it caused you to look at mental health issues and suicide in a different way? Have you or a family member had your own battles with depression and suicidal thoughts? Was it hard for you to talk about and to go out and seek help? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Leah Rolando is the Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Leah, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Leah, a lot of people in the mental health community seem to have responded to this interview and what Meghan Markle had to say about her own experiences with suicidal thoughts. What's your reaction to what you heard in that interview and since?
Yeah, what I've seen at least is just more and more people relating to that and sharing about their own experiences. I mean, at least what I've seen, and I have so many incredible friends and colleagues who have lived experience with suicidal thoughts or suicide attempts. And so a lot of these folks have been sharing their stories and hoping it encourages other people to also speak up about this. But another story we see in that is that when Meghan shared that she tried to reach out, there was that, Well, it's bad for the institution. And so I see like a lot of parallels to what others have shared with me before and shared with folks in the field, that, you know, we're telling folks to reach out. But when folks are reaching out, what are they being met with?
Right. We're not all parts of a royal family, but that concern about maybe stigma or what people are going to think of us if we talk about these issues, that's still real for everyone, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you say to people who see that interview maybe and think, well, that's like my experience, but I don't know where to start. I don't know where to reach out. I don't know how to strike up this conversation, maybe even with a close loved one.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ideas that I have, and I'm interested in seeing more people's reactions to this. I guess I would just like encourage people, if you are family members or friends of people who have lived experience with suicide or have shared that they've been suicidal before, just listen to them. Just hold space for folks and let people tell you what they're dealing with, and don't push back against that, trying to kind of sugarcoat their experience or saying like, well, how could you be suicidal? You have a great family. Or how could you be suicidal? You have all these great things going for you. Because that's, you know, incredibly dismissive when somebody's in that moment and feeling that.
And then for someone who's concerned about a loved one, but hasn't heard about suicidal thoughts, I know there's often a concern, and in the past there was a concern even among mental health professionals. Well, I don't want to bring up the idea of self-harm or suicide or suicidal thoughts, because am I going to put that idea in their head where it wasn't before? Thinking on that has changed, it sounds like. What do you say to that, Leah?
Yeah, I think more and more people are recognizing that that's a myth, that bringing up suicidal thoughts or asking somebody if they're thinking about suicide is going to plant the idea in their head. Because we know, and I think I've said time and time again, that asking people, you know, do you feel like being on this earth anymore? Do you feel like dying? You open up this conversation and you let that person know that you are ready to hear what they have to say. Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say it's more than mental health too. I think so often in the field of suicide prevention and mental health, we reduce suicidal thoughts to a symptom of a mental illness. And we think that suicide has to be a symptom of an undiagnosed mental illness. And that's simply not true. Obviously, racism, homophobia, sexism, all these bigger picture things are impacting the mental health of people. And so it's not just this individualized mental illness. So I just really want to encourage people to think about this more broadly.
We're talking to Leah Rolando, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We are talking about how we talk about suicide and suicidal thoughts. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and experiences. Did you watch that interview with Meghan Markle and talking to Oprah Winfrey, where she talked about her own suicidal thoughts? And did it change the way you think about these issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chandra is with us in Ironwood. Chandra, hi.
Hi there. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chandra?
I live in a small rural community in Ironwood, Michigan, and we struggle a lot with mental illness and suicide. And I think we have one of the highest suicide rates per capita in the area. So one of the things I really struggled with was after I had my son, I had postpartum depression that actually made me feel very suicidal. And the ideations, I'd been struggling with my whole life, but I had never come up with a plan. And so I was here, I was a new mom. I didn't know a lot of people. I was pretty new to the area. And, you know, I was suicidal, and I knew that I was sick. And I think that's one of the main things that people need to realize is that we're, you know, when we get to that point, we are sick and we need help, just like somebody that has a disease needs help. So I called the local agencies and to talk to a psychologist. And my problem in my community, and something I'm very passionate about changing, is preventative help is key. So we are very much a community that when you attempt suicide, when you, are out of your mind and be acting out in different ways, you can get help, but it's like you have to go to the ER and they put a cop outside your room, and then they transfer you to another psych hospital and hold you for 72 hours, give you some medications, throw you right back into the same situation. And most of the time, those communities don't have enough resources to actually help people recover from that mental health situation or crisis or whatever. Yeah. With all the underlying things that come up with suicide attempts and depression and all of those things, we just do not have the resources. And the studies show that if you invest in mental health in your community, you are going to see less crime rates, less domestic violence, less, overdoses, less incarceration. So, I just don't know why we aren't investing in this when the best practices are showing that these things work.
Chandra, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. I appreciate that you're willing to talk about it. And Leah, Chandra says, okay, in the moment of crisis, yeah, you could call 911 and it's an extreme situation. Chandra wants to see more help early, preventative, and after that moment of crisis, you know, to help people get better. What do you think?
Yeah, so you're speaking to all of that kind of upstream prevention and what do we do before people are in crisis and how do we actually have help available when people are reaching out for help if that's what we're telling them to do. And I think we've seen a lot of really creative solutions come from peer support. So rather than just focusing on clinical types of treatment, like therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists, how can peer support people in their communities? Do you have a peer-run respite? I know we have a few in Wisconsin, and they're like home-like settings for folks to go to who can be with people who have also dealt with mental health or substance use or thoughts of suicide. There's also groups like Alternatives to Suicide, which is a new a group that Mental Health America of Wisconsin just launched. The idea comes from an organization called the Wildflower Alliance, and they really focus on peers talking to other peers. So people who have been there and people who aren't going to hit the panic button when somebody says that they're thinking about suicide. So I think there's a lot of different things that we can point to and think about when we're thinking about how much people are struggling and how can we help folks. So I appreciate you really being an advocate for that and sharing your own lived experience to kind of emphasize that.
Chandra, thanks again for calling in. We're talking about reducing the stigma surrounding mental health and suicidal thoughts. Leah Rolando is with us, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Meghan Markle in that interview with Oprah saying she's had suicidal thoughts? Did that resonate with you? If you or someone you know contemplated suicide, how difficult was it to open up and get help? And have you been involved in one of those peer peer counseling, peer support groups in Wisconsin that our guest or beyond that our guest was talking about? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking about reducing the stigma of suicidal thoughts after former Duchess of Sussex Meghan Markle told Oprah Winfrey in an interview that she had suicidal thoughts since joining the royal family. Leah Rolando is our guest, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if those comments resonated with you, sounded like something you might have gone through in your own life or someone in your family had. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Leah, you mentioned how peers can support people earlier who maybe say, yeah, I'm having suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation. And you used an important phrase there, without hitting the panic button. For somebody in that situation, how do they know? I mean, if you're not familiar, if you're not ready for that, it would be easy for me, say, to overreact to somebody telling me that. How do I not do that?
Yeah, it takes a lot of, you know, getting in touch with the, like, I don't know, like kind of darker moments that you've had personally and just holding space for other people. I know that's really kind of hard to define, but for example, there's a recent training that we've gone through and we've kind of learned how to be with someone and not try to fix what they're saying, not try to rush to offering solutions, but really listening to what someone's saying, just kind of staying curious about that, sharing parts of yourself too. I know a lot of clinicians are taught to be kind of blank slates and very not sharing pieces of their stories with clients when clients are sharing that they've been suicidal. But we're learning that there's so much to gain from just being human with one another and just validating the pain that other people have gone through.
Let's go back to our callers. Mary is with us in Racine. Mary, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you want to tell us about, Mary?
I think that adults really don't pay a whole lot of attention to children who have suicidal ideation. Where I lived when I was 11, there were two boys next door, 9 and 7, who hung themselves from the balcony over their staircase and killed themselves. And I was 11, and I thought I was having suicidal ideations like that already. And I thought, I can do that. That's my way out. I also have an older sister who was in the hospital twice for suicide attempts. And my parents just laughed at her and said, "What's wrong with you?" So I think that especially professionals, maybe they're getting better, but adults in general are not paying attention to what's going on with children who have suicidal ideations. And a lot of this is chemical, because children are having all those body changes. And, you know, I'm not a doctor, but there's got to be more people that have to recognize this more.
Mary, thank you for calling in. I'm sorry you went through that as a kid. Let's talk about children in particular, Leah, and watching for warning signs. And maybe it may be tougher for kids to even express those ideas, even for an adult, than for an adult struggling with the same issues.
Yeah, I'm really glad you bring that up. I'm not an expert on this, like, in particular clinically, but I know that it's so common, you know, for adults to experience suicidal thoughts, and the suicidal thoughts can start a lot younger for kids too. And just going back to that myth of, like, planting the idea in their head, like, that's not necessarily true. Like, kids are going to learn about this stuff eventually. And so just having proactive conversations about feelings and doing promoting social emotional development in schools. I know there's a lot of different programs now that schools can implement, starting in elementary school, for kids to start talking about their feelings and their actions and how they respond to difficult, you know, life events. And so I think just more of that, and teachers who are educated on having these difficult conversations, and parents and caregivers too.
Thanks again for that call. In our last few moments, I want to touch on some good news down the road anyway. The state's Health Services Department announced that it received a grant to help set up a new calling code for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Next summer, it'll be a 3-digit number, and not yet. But how important is this, Leah, to have this in the pipeline to make it easier, just in our last 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack in 30 seconds, because we know it's not active yet, but we know that it's super important that we're funding crisis services and peer services who are ready to receive folks when they're calling into that number when it is active. So we just really want to push for policies and legislation that's going to make it possible to make sure the help is there when people are seeking that help. So it's more than just that number. It's making sure we have a fully funded crisis system with peer support fully considered. So lots more to say, but it's very important.
Leah, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yes, thanks so much.
Leah Rolando is the Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator for Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We talked through about Meghan Markle saying she's had suicidal thoughts since becoming a member of the royal family, and how her revelation could help those with mental health issues. By the way, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. You can reach a crisis text line by texting HOME to the number 741-741. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with an ongoing series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. School districts around the state have used online learning throughout the pandemic, forcing students and families as well as teachers to learn a whole new method for school. Teacher Julie Welch of La Crosse says she's found unexpected joy in switching to a virtual classroom, but she says that hasn't been the case for many of her colleagues.
Never in my 30 years of teaching did I ever dream of being an online teacher. I love technology, sort of have a love-hate relationship with it, truthfully, in the fact that I like some of the things it can do, but I've always been pretty vocal about wanting kids to be off the screen. So when the pandemic came and we had to suddenly switch, and now it's like oh, go home and teach from home and use Zoom. I was like, how do I do that? I had no idea. And so last March and April and May was a huge learning curve, huge. But it was amazing. It's amazing what you can learn to do when you have to. I have some health reasons to be home, and I kind of was forced to apply. It was either that or take a leave of absence. I'm close to retirement, but I'm not quite there yet. And so I still want to teach. I'm still able to teach, but I just needed to be able to do it safely. I went in with big reservations. The very first thing I did with my new students in the fall was I had a one-on-one Zoom meeting with every family, and I was very upfront and very honest and said, hey, I'm going to do the very best I can, and I'll expect you to do the very best you can, but we're going to, you know, have to help each other. Now that I'm in it, I absolutely love it. Like, I am amazed how much I love online teaching. What I find is I'm spending my days laughing and teaching and working with kids, and I'm spending the whole day teaching. And I'm not, you know, I'm not spending a lot of time doing a lot of other tasks that often regular teachers in the school day are pulled to do. I'm not doing bus duty and recess duty and hallway duty. And, you know, there's a lot of things that in school, regular teachers are expected, and we just do. We care about students, and so we do those things. I feel like I am having a very unique experience. Yes, there's been stresses, but it is nowhere near what I see my colleagues who are teaching in person are experiencing. Not even close. For a lot of human beings, change can be stressful, and the not knowing, the uncertainty is very stressful. You know, my coworkers who are in person are having to do the teaching, but then also figure out the cleaning and figure out the safety protocols, and they have to walk their students every place and keep their students physically safe. And teachers are very conscientious about that, and they care so much about their students that's an added layer of stress for them that I don't have to worry about. And so I really, really feel for my coworkers that are in person. They're doing it. They're not complaining. They're not quitting. But they are exhausted, and they need all the support we can give them.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Coming up after the news, changes in everyday routines have also meant changes in when and how we eat. We talked to a journalist about why so many people have given up on 3 meals a day. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, what's in the new pandemic economic relief bill, and what does it mean for you? Kate Archer-Kent and her guests break down the new spending, and you can join in with your questions and reactions. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, many people have found themselves drifting away from the 3-meal-a-day format as daily routines have changed. Could be because you're choosing to eat when you're hungry rather than when your schedule allows. You're eating more snacks or smaller, more frequent meals. Or maybe what you're doing is what our next guest has called the big meal, which is what it sounds like. One big meal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found your eating habits changing over the last year? Do you have more flexibility to eat when you're hungry rather than just when you have time? Or are you fitting in meals when you can around, say, helping your kids learn from home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering health. She wrote the piece, "There's No Real Reason to Eat 3 Meals a Day." Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, in your piece, Amanda, you say people are taking this in a lot of different ways. What are some of the most common changes you're seeing for people who have shaken up their daily eating routines?
in my research, it seems like people are changing in a couple different ways, depending on the structure of their lives now. Personally, I, before the pandemic, was always a big 3-meal-a-day eater, like since childhood. It was always a pattern I felt really natural about. I never questioned it, nothing. But I, being a person who lives alone in an apartment, who has to feed myself, but only me, you know, I sort of get to call all the shots and make all the decisions about my daily eating habits. And so what I have noticed, and what other people in similar situations have noticed, is that, you know, doing all that prep work and all of those dishes, you know, without being able to split that work with anybody is kind of a lot. So a lot of people who live by themselves have gone the route I have, where, you know, at first I went from 3 meals to 2 meals, and then I was sick of doing those dishes too for that second meal. And I wasn't really that hungry, because you're not moving around a whole lot. I live in New York, so I've stopped walking as much as I used to before the pandemic. So I really only wanted one meal, so I just did that. And there's nobody here to tell me they're hungry and that they need to eat more, so it's fine. And I just eat snacks the rest of the day. And then for people who have kids, you know, things can go in a lot of different directions, depending on how old your kids are, depending on, you know, if you're working from home full time or just part of the time or not working from home at all. But kids, you know, require a little bit more structure than people like me who live by themselves. So people I talked to had, you know, found opportunities to not necessarily cook more, but cook different things. If you're home part of the week while your son or daughter is learning online, then maybe you put something in the oven a couple hours before you would normally be able to do it. Maybe you put something in the crock pot. Maybe you make a soup. So there's just like a lot of opportunity to do like little tasks throughout the day if you're at home. And then I also talked to one woman whose children are getting a little bit older, and one of them is in middle school. And because she's been at home and she likes to cook, she has sort of been able to, you know, get in the kitchen with her eldest son, who has shown a lot of interest in cooking. And now he makes lunch sometimes if he has time in his break from Zoom school. Sometimes he makes lunch for her. So she told me that she really valued the fact that she had gotten to have that in-person time with him that she wouldn't have had otherwise. So it really just depends on what the needs of your household are and how your day-to-day has changed. And those things determine how you're eating now, probably.
And you write, Amanda, maybe some of us feel weird about the ways our eating has changed, but you grew up with 3 meals a day. So do I. That's usually my weekday routine, even now. There's nothing automatic in human biology that says 3 meals a day is the optimal way to go, right?
Right. For pretty much everybody alive in America right now, the 3-meal-a-day thing has never really been questioned on a cultural level. It's what we grew up with. It's what our parents did. It gets reinforced over and over again in popular culture, in you know, messages about health that we get from media. So when I started to change, when my eating habits started to sort of change on their own, I got a little bit worried that I was doing something that was sort of inherently unhealthy for me, and that maybe it would be worth it for my sanity or my physical health and all of this to like force myself to eat more times per day or to have more distinct meals instead of just snacks here and there when I'm hungry. So I talked to a food historian about this, and what she told me is that our 3-meal-a-day standard is pretty much a result of industrialization. And specifically, lots of people who would have worked at home, on farms, in the house, getting conscripted into more formalized types of labor, where people leave the house and go to a factory, they go to an office, they go to, you know, any of the workplaces that a lot of us have been missing in the past year. So, and that really starts to accelerate around the time that you get a lot of food industrialization. So you've got this new set of products, and a lot of them are being marketed for breakfast for workers leaving the house early in ways that they didn't used to. And a lot of those tend to be sort of cold and small and nutritionally hollow, cereal, instant oatmeal, things like that. They don't get you very far during the day. So when people worked more in and around their homes, whether it was, you know, agrarian, whether it was people, you know, making things to sell in the workshop out back, things like that. They usually ate two large meals per day. Now you've got breakfast foods that are marketed as such for the first time that don't get you very far during the day. And then you have to leave the house. So you've got breakfast and then, you know, middle of the day, you're hungry again. So you eat lunch. And then by the time you get done with work and commute home, you're hungry a third time, which brings us to the idea of three meals a day that we're so used to. But for the vast majority of human history before we developed cornflakes, it just wasn't what humans did.
We're talking to Amanda Mall, staff writer at The Atlantic, about how our eating habits have changed during the pandemic. Has your meal schedule changed? Do you eat different numbers of meals, more snacks, fewer snacks? A lot of people doing it in different ways. Or have you stayed the course? Are you a three squares a day person then and now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Amanda, even when I'm, you know, kind of setting my own schedule, I don't know, in some ways I build my day at work or at home, whatever, around those meal times. So it isn't so much the nutritional requirements as, I don't know, some kind of ritual requirement for me or something. I don't know. Is that normal or am I the weird one there?
No, I think that that is normal too. And I think that what people are doing right now and balancing the sort of functional differences of the last year versus the psychological needs that we have. And if meals are like a good way to mark time for you during the day, and you don't mind doing the manual labor of cooking for yourself three times a day, or if you have people at home to split that labor with, or if you're going into work and your life is a little bit more normal than people who are stuck at home still, then I think that that's totally fine. If that is satisfying to you physically or psychologically, then I think that you should do that. And I think that the thing that I have learned in the past year about food is that just find what is physically and psychologically satisfying to you and do that.
And some of us worry about that. I mean, food in normal times, people get stressed out. Am I eating the right thing? Am I eating the right amount of stuff? Do you worry that as we shake up our routines, even if it's in ways that aren't harmful, that we're still going to stress out and freak out about it even more?
I think that we have sort of been encouraged as Americans to worry about our diet in ways that we don't necessarily have solutions for. I talked to a dietitian for this article, somebody who specializes in eating disorders in low-income patients. So someone who sees a lot of very genuine psychological and practical problems with eating on a day-to-day basis. And what she told me is that between sort of the extremely lucrative diet industry in this country and the extremely lucrative processed food industry, you have a lot of sort of messaging in the world in media about eat this, not that, eat this many times a day, eat these types of things, eat, you know, certain mixtures of carbs and dairy and protein and fats. And what she told me in that, she said that what she tells her clients is that if you listen to your body, if you don't force yourself into a routine that feels unnatural to you, if you don't force yourself to eat when you're not hungry just because you think you need to eat a certain number of times a day, a lot of this sort of comes out in the wash. If you can find circumstances in which what you're doing feels like it's a response to something your body is telling you and not a response to the signals you get from outside of yourself, then that goes like a really long way to ensuring that whatever you're eating, whatever mixture of things you're eating, and however it varies day to day, you know, a solid mixture of things for you.
We're talking to Amanda Mull, staff writer at The Atlantic, about a recent piece about our pandemic eating habits and how they have changed over the last year for a lot of people, including for many, a venture away from the three meals a day routine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. Have you changed your eating routine in your day? Have you gone with the one big meal plan? Regular snacking? Do you cook more, cook less? What's taking the place of restaurants for you? Is it restaurant takeout or more cooking or more prepared foods? What has this year in eating looked like for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Amanda Mull, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're talking about how our food and mealtime habits have changed during the pandemic. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Have you stayed the course? Have you worked to make sure you keep up your regular eating routine? Or have you gone through a big change of some sort from the one big meal theory or to, you know, my weekend favorite brunch and dinner? I stick with three meals a day during the weekday usually. How about you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Surprised not getting calls on this. I think, I don't know, maybe we're all staying the course here in Wisconsin and not changing anything. And Amanda, I guess that's probably true for some people. Not everybody's out there shaking up the way they eat. A lot of people, of course, still going to that factory or office.
Right. There's a lot of people out there who whose day-to-day life has not changed a ton in at this point. There's a lot of people who have been asked to return to work. A lot of people who didn't get to leave work in the first place at the beginning of the pandemic to quarantine. So I would imagine that for those people, a lot of their routines have stayed the same, with the exception of maybe some differences in how they eat during the workday, because if, especially like, I know that here, if you commute into Manhattan, if you did that before the pandemic, a lot of the places that you ate lunch in the really office heavy areas of the city are not there anymore because they went without business for so long. So there are functional aspects to how one eats and how many times a day one eats that exist outside of the home, of course.
And you write, Amanda, that there are class differences in the changes we've had during the pandemic. So for some people, we might be subscribing to fancy, high-end things. Some people might be learning to cook new things. Some people might be struggling to figure out how they can afford food or lining up at a food bank.
Yes, it's really important to highlight this. I think millions of Americans who previously were able to buy groceries and feed themselves and feed their families have become food insecure in the last year, have a hard time getting groceries, have to go to food banks, as you said. A lot of people have lost wages. Those wages have not come back for a lot of people. So for people in that situation, you have to figure out how to feed everybody on a really stingy budget, and in ways that perhaps in your previous life you never had to deal with. So there's been a learning curve there for sure. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, if you can afford all of the bells and whistles and delivery you want, maybe you've spent the last year eating takeout from every restaurant in your neighborhood or something like that. Maybe you've ordered a bunch of fancy meal kits. Maybe you have bought full new sets of cookware to try recipes on your own. There is a whole continuum of experience depending on your economic and social conditions.
Well, now we've got some callers. Let's go to Jay in Green Bay. Jay, hello.
Hey, how's it going there?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jay?
Oh, pandemic, pandemonium in the kitchen. I love cooking, and I went all out and made probably about 7 or 8 different Thanksgiving whole full meals. And I mean, I love cooking. Thanksgiving is, I mean, one of my favorite meals to cook. I mean, more guests the merrier, as far as I was concerned. And, it was just uncontrollable, though, and I have depression big time, and the extra cooking probably helped calm down the depression. So,
Interesting.
I was just gobbling up Thanksgiving all through the year.
Awesome. Jay, thank you so much for sharing that. And Jay, I think an experience a lot of people had, Amanda, cooking as a mental health practice.
Yes, this is definitely something I've done a lot over the past year. I think cooking can really be great for people who are struggling with feelings of depression, feelings of anxiety, because it's a tactile thing. It's something that requires you to stand up, move around, put your phone down, get your hands dirty, literally and figuratively, and then you get this beautiful thing at the end, this beautiful physical result of your work. And then you get to eat it, which is great. So I think that tasks like that, that involve people doing stuff with their hands, doing stuff that gets them up and moving around their homes, is really, really helpful for a lot of people in that situation. I think that is also why we've seen a big rise in baking. And then baking is also something that you can share with other people. So if you've got friends in the neighborhood that you haven't seen in a little while, or that you have been thinking about, or that you just want to show some care to because they're going through a tough time, you know, bake something, keep half of it for yourself, give half of it to a friend. It's like a nice little bit of connection in all of this.
Jay, thanks for the call. And I do endorse Thanksgiving whenever you want to make it. We'll go to Mike now in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What was your change, Mike?
I've been working remotely for, I guess, just about a year now since the pandemic. And I have never really been much of a breakfast guy since I was a kid. But I was doing lunch. And since the pandemic, I've really just having the one large meal, generally relatively late at night, to be honest. But I'm really enjoying doing the cooking and all that once I got kind of over the annoyance and sort of trepidation of going to the grocery store and having to do all the wipe down of everything when I get mm-hmm. back. I've enjoyed it, and I've actually lost quite a bit of weight on it. So I've been kind of doing that and basically just cooking all my own stuff aside from the occasional junky delivery pizza or whatever it might be.
It sounds good, Mike. What do you, I mean, do you snack during the day, or are you just saving it all up for the big meal at night?
I kind of save it up for, at most I'll kind of have a glass of V8 or something like that during lunch. But oftentimes just tea, and then kind of, I don't know, emotionally it kind of gives me the free range to kind of almost be gluttonous at night on that one meal because I'm really kind of saving all my calories for that one time frame.
Interesting, Mike. Thanks a lot. So there is a fellow big meal advocate for you, Amanda.
Right. And something that he mentioned is that, you know, sort of reconfiguring how you think about meals. If you're someone who is doing a lot of the cooking for yourself, sort of focusing on one meal a day, and whether you're eating snacks the rest of the day or not is up to you, but it gives you the opportunity to make something a little nice for yourself, to really focus on making a beautiful meal, whether it's a pasta or, you know, cooking yourself a steak or something like that, since you're not constantly working three times a day in order to feed yourself all these separate meals. You can put all that effort into one thing and get sort of maximum benefit out of that.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Mike. In our last minute, Amanda, you are on the big meal schedule for the most part. Do you anticipate that you're going to stick with it even when life is back to quote unquote normal?
You know, I think I'm going to try to stick with it as much as I can, because the reality of having to commute to and from work, that's an hour each way for me usually. So it means that I can't have my sort of like mid-afternoon cooking experience that I've been having these days. But I think that there's ways around that. And I think that now that I know that this feels natural and this feels good for me, there's maybe some planning I can do to make that a little bit easier. So I'm going to try to. It's less expensive too.
Amanda, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering health. She wrote the piece, "There's No Real Reason to Eat Three Meals a Day." We've got a link up to that at WPR.org/Central Time. And you can keep sharing your stories of how your food habits have changed during the pandemic, if at all. You can do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the COVID relief bill passed by Congress includes child tax credits aimed at boosting the economy and tackling poverty. A Wisconsin poverty researcher joins the show for a look at the plan and what it could mean. And COVID-19 vaccines are coming out faster and faster, but what about people who are afraid of needles? A guest offers advice to help them get the life-saving injection. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. A while back, we talked about our reading habits during the pandemic. We heard from you. Some are reading lots more. Some of you have had trouble concentrating. Some of you had suggestions to share. We're going to keep those suggestions going on now with producer Jana Rose Schleiss. Jana Rose, hi.
Hey, Rob.
Now, you've been on team reading lots during the pandemic. Do I have that right?
Reading probably too much.
Too much. No, that can't happen. And you have a book to share with us. What are you liking?
I want to recommend the book, You Never Forget Your First. It's a biography of George Washington written by Alexis Coe, and she's actually the first woman to write a biography about George Washington in over 40 years.
Okay, and what is it about this biography of George Washington that's selling it to you out of the, probably hundreds of them out there?
Right. I like this because at only 209 pages, it's much more accessible than those giant books that you see on display about the founding fathers every year around Father's Day. And it's pretty funny.
A funny book about George Washington.
A funny book. Like, she writes a resume for him, all of the different positions that he held. She lists off all of the different diseases he survived, which, considering the medical establishment at the time, is pretty impressive.
All right. And the title again?
You Never Forget Your First by Alexis Coe.
Jana Rose, thanks. You can keep sharing your book suggestions on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.